Welcome. So today I want to say still a few words, maybe a bit more than a few, about the BLST symmetry. And then I'd like to address a few, introduce you to some issue of topology in Gale series, and especially I will introduce you to the famous instanton problem or instanton configuration. Okay, so now first, BRST. I'm going to be very general again, but I remember you that I remind you that what we have been doing is that BRST appear. One way to have BRST appear is to perform quantization of a gauge series, non-abelian gauge series, by just a functional integral method, so the naive functional integral method, which is a way to derive a calculational tool for perturbation theory, but more than that. And I've explained you how the Fadiyev-Popov procedure of gauge fixing allows to derive a sensible perturbation theory rules by fixing in a consistent way a gauge symmetry, choosing a gauge in order to treat in a proper way the redundancy in the physics which is contained by the fact the theory has a local gauge invariance. So the field which is convenient to consider in quantization, the vector potential AMU, in fact, has this local gauge invariance redundancy. So the real physics is contained in the stress energy tensor, but AMU is a fundamental object to consider when quantizing the theory. Okay, so remember that for SU2, for instance, what we had is that we start from an AMU. In fact, it's a matrix, so it contains ATA, where TA is a generator of SU2. And the gauge action is integral over X of and if I'm writing things properly, that's 1/2 g² trace of f mu nu. I'm in Euclidean for simplicity, so that's explained why there is a 1/2 plus 1/2 and minus 1/2. I take the trace using the fact that the trace of the generator is 1, and then you have to add to this if you use the Landau gauge, mu mu equal 0, you have to add the famous. So I'm going to write this everything in terms of trace, which can be done properly by B d mu mu. So this is the auxiliary field. And the gauge fixing term, which is C d mu d mu C, and then the C bar here. Okay, and I've wrote things a bit more in a more compact way than yesterday because I'm taking the trace that sums over the color indices mu both of the gauge field, the ghost, the anti-ghost, and the auxiliary field. And if you are interested in the Landau-Feynman gauge, then you have to add to these terms plus chi/4b². When chi equals 0, we recover the Landau. Chi is different from 0, this is Feynman. Okay, and we have seen that in fact this action, that's a full gauge fix action, has a BRST symmetry. Yes?
Is the 1/2 g² out front or just the curvature?
This is a curvature. tensor.
Right, but the 1 over 2 to b squared, is that in front of the whole thing or just that first term?
No, no. No, yeah, you are right. Well, you can rescale things if you like, but you are right. You are right. I'm sorry. Yeah. That's... Yes. Yeah, well, you can rescale both C bars and B in order to have that.
I see.
That's what you are going to do when you make an expansion. That's not very important, but you are right. That's better. Okay. Okay. And so we have seen that we have this BRST symmetry, which is generated by some Q with, if I remember well, Q on A mu is I, is just D U of C. Q of C is I over 2 CC. Q of C bar is minus, is it I epsilon or minus I epsilon? I B and Q of B is zero, which has a fundamental property that first this gauge fixing term is invariant and Q square equals zero, and Q of the gauge fixing term zero because the S gauge fixing can be written as Q of something, and not something, but simply C bar times trace integral of the trace of C bar times the gauge fixing condition in UM. So you see, the gauge fixing condition appears simply by this very simple formula in the form of the gauge fixing. This is the gauge fixing. And you see that the BRST transformation doesn't depend on the gauge fixing. It's something absolute, which is contained by the structure of the algebra of the group. The structure of the group appears in the d mu and in this commutator. Okay, and so what I did, so this is an example. You see that, in fact, of course, Q of this is zero because this is gauge invariant. So the Lagrangian density trace of F mu is invariant by Q. The gauge fixing action density is invariant. In fact, the integral is not important. And in general, in fact, gauge invariant function, so gauge invariant physical quantity, physical observable, in the path integral formulas are just function of A, but of course in this formula of C, C bars and B, local observable. And the fact that they are physical means that they have to be gauge invariant, because otherwise they are not physical, because in gauge transformation are just transformation of a fiducial variable of redundant. So physical observable has to satisfy just Q of O equals zero. So that's the condition for a physical observable to be gauge invariant in this form example. Q applied to a function, it can be a complicated function of the fields, has to be equal to zero. So physical observables are annihilated by the BRST generator Q. Okay. And of course, this is going to enforce to put a lot of constraint on the observable, which are physical observable invariant. That's true, of course, for the amplitude in particular. Okay, so now what I want to say is just explain very briefly that the BRST formalism symmetry, which has been explained here and derived in the context of functional integral, can be also, in fact, constructed in the context of the canonical quantization. So I'm not going to discuss that at all in detail. This is discussed in the Peskin and Schroeder book, for instance. And the fact that there is a BRST property in canonical quantization is, you are going to see that plays a very important role in theories can be treated by canonical quantization, where the gauge symmetry is not SU2 group, but it's what's called the conformal symmetry, the symmetry under conformal transformation. That's very important both in condensed matter, and that's very important for string theory, where the, you have this huge Virasoro or super Virasoro algebra, which is a, some kind of gauge symmetry, much more complicated than SU2. And but in order to quantize gauge, for instance, string theory, there is some BRST operator and symmetry going on. Okay, so in canonical quantization, in fact, you have, even if you can quantize gauge theories, like non-abelian perturbation theory, for instance, what you have is that you have an Hilbert space of states with states psi with vector. Okay, but if you construct an Hilbert space starting from the full theory with the gauge fixed theory with ghosts, see, in canonical quantization, you are going to have not only a creation and annihilation operator for the mode of the gauge field, but you are going to have creation and annihilation operator for the modes of the ghost and the anti-ghost. I'm not going to explain that, but you can construct that either by canonical quantization, starting from the equation of motion for the theory with gauge fixing, or you can construct an Hilbert space out of functional integral. You know that, in fact, in quantum theory, that's already true in quantum mechanics, you can construct the scalar products between some out and some in space by a functional integral, but basically defining a functional integral on over some space-time. You see, this is time, this is time, this is space. But instead of having the infinite space-time, you specify what are the initial condition in the functional integral and the final, and by a path integral where one fixes some initial and final boundaries or condition in the path integral or in the functional integral, that's a way to compute matrix elements between initial and final states in the quantum field theory. And this scalar products, in fact, construct the Hilbert space. So there is a bit of a formal at that level way, but it can make mirrors to construct an Hilbert space with a Hilbert scalar product out of a functional integral. For the free field, you can do that very explicitly in that combinant. But that's a general idea that one has to keep in mind. So that's a connection between path integral and canonical quantization. Okay? Okay, so that now if you have, you can construct what is the Hilbert space for the theory which contains both gauge field, ghost, anti-ghost, and this auxiliary field which doesn't propagate, so it's a bit special. And it turns out that since you have the ghosts violate the spin statistic theorem, because they are fermions with spin zero, it means that one expects problems with unitarity when quantizing the theory doing this way. And the fact that you have problem with unitarity is that this Hilbert space is not, in fact, positively definite. States built out of creation and annihilation operator of ghosts and anti-ghosts, they may have a scalar product which is negative, which means that you may have negative probability. So in fact, in this Hilbert space, it's a pseudo Hilbert space. Yes, I think that's the correct denomination. That's a pseudo Hilbert space. You may have some states which are positive, but it can be zero. Those are null states. It's the analog of the light cone vector on the light cone in a Minkowski metric, or negative. Okay. And
that's François.
Yes.
We saw in Q2 that longitudinal and time like photons.
Yes.
We also have this type of norm.
Yes. Yes.
So I'm just wondering, but they aren't the ghosts.
In this formulation, you can relate the ghost C. That's explained, a bit sketchily, but that's explained in Peskin-Schroeder. You can relate the Cs to the longitudinal modes. And you can relate the C bars and Bs to what I call the transverse mode, what's the terminology? Backwards modes. You have two kinds of
transverse.
No, transverse.
Time-like.
What? Time-like, but backwards.
Time-like.
Yeah, when you have a photon, imagine that this is in ordinary space-time. This is the light cone. Okay, and. When you have a photon, it propagates along the light cone in one direction. So you have four kinds of polarization. You have the polarization which are transverse. Well, I should rather write this in two dimensions like that. So you have polarization which are here, which are forwards. You have polarization like that. This is a polarization in space-time. So you see, in space, you have a photon. That's a one-dimensional space. You have a polarization like that. That's forwards. You can have polarization like that. This is backwards. And then you have the orthogonal polarization, which are the transverse polarization, the physical. Okay, and so the forwards polarization, in fact, I described by creation and annihilation of Cs, and the backwards polarization are created by the C bar. Okay, that's what comes out, but I'm not going to explain that. I just want to explain a few simple things about this, which is basically that in canonical quantization, you have this big Hilbert space, let's call it H. But now this Hilbert space has a non-positive definite scalar products. But the generator of the BRST symmetry Q, which here is defined in the path integral formalism. In fact, in the function canonical quantization, the standard formulation of quantum theory, it becomes an operator. So Q click on an operator acting in on physical on set vector. Okay, so it becomes an operator which has two properties. First, Q is Hermitian. It's equals its adjoint, but its Hermitian with respect to the non-positive metric. So basically, the, you see, Q dagger is defined by the fact that A times QB is dagger A. That's a standard definition of the conjugate of an operator, the adjoint. Self-adjoint, the adjoint operator. So Q is self-adjoint, but Q squared is also equal to zero because the fundamental properties of Q is that it is nilpotent. Okay, and in a positive definite Hilbert space, this and this implies that Q equals zero. Because if it's self-adjoint, you can diagonalize it. The fact that Q squared equals zero means that all its eigenvalues are zero. But since it is not positive definite, Q is not zero. Okay? You can check easily that it's possible. So since Q, yeah, that's because non-positivity. Okay. And so it's a very special kind of operator. And in fact, how does one construct the state, the space of physical states? Here I have defined what are physical observables. But what are physical observables? So physical observables are just operators acting in this Hilbert space, which commutes with Q. As usual, that's a symmetry. Operators that are invariant under a symmetry are operators that commute with the generator of this symmetry. So gauge invariant observables are operators that commute with Q. Now, what are physical states? Okay. In this big Hilbert space, you have a lot of states which are unphysical because they have zero scalar products or negative scalar products. And some are positive scalar products, but that doesn't mean that they are necessarily physical. So in fact, you have your big Hilbert space, you see, you have your big Hilbert space. And in this Hilbert space, so let's assume that this is a big Hilbert space. In this Hilbert space, there is a subspace which is, you have two subspaces. You have a subspace which is the kernel of Q. That's a set of space which are such that Q psi equals zero. Okay? So you would say, okay, if a state is annotated by Q, it should be physical. So out of care of the kernel of Q, one expects to be able to construct what are the physical states of the theory, the states which describes, you know, things you can observe. Okay, but there is a problem because there is another state which is a state which is the image of Q. It's the set of states which can be written as Q times some chi. Okay. And well, you expect those to be physical state. Why? Because Q squared is equal to zero. So Q squared equals zero means that the image of the BST operator is included into the kernel of Q. So you have here the kernel of Q, the set of wave vectors which are annihilated by Q, and inside that you have a substate which is subspace which is M of Q. Okay. But now consider that you have a state A and a state B, and you consider what is the matrix element, the scalar products between A and B. Now, change A into A prime, which is A plus some Q of something, let's say Q of C. Okay. And the same way, consider that you change B into B prime, into B plus Q of D. Okay. Well, then, using the fact that Q squared equals zero and that Q is self-adjoint, you can easily show that the scalar product of A with B is equal to the scalar product of A prime with B prime for any A and B, if you have chosen some C and some D's. So in particular, of course, this induces, if you assume that A is zero, it's a wave vector which is zero, that the scalar products of two vectors which are in the image of Q is zero. You see? So in fact, it means that you cannot see all the matrix elements of vectors which are in the image of Q. You cannot see them. They have matrix elements zero with any physical observable. So in fact, it means that if you consider, you see, you consider a vector, a point somewhere in the vector of Q, in the kernel of Q, you had it, some element of M of Q. It has the same matrix element with the other vectors. So in fact, taking a vector, a wave vector, and adding any vector in the image of Q, this describes the same physical states. Because you only have access in quantum mechanics to the matrix element, the scalar products. This defines the amplitude probability of going from one state to another one. Okay. So in fact, the subspace of physical states is just the state of physical gauge invariant or Q invariant wave vectors, but quotiented by the image of Q. In fact, what you are considering is not the vector inside this big vector, but the orbits by Q. So in fact, it is those line which describe physical. So this is a way one constructs the Hilbert space of physical states. You have this big Hilbert space of all the states. You take the kernel of Q, the set of states which are annihilated by two, but you divide by the image of Q because up to those transformations, this is exactly describe the same physical states. And this is H physical. And this H physical, when construct, you can show that this is a well-defined Hilbert state with a positive definite product. So it's a, you have a real, the real quantum mechanics is defined here. Yes?
Can you explain a bit more the connection between these negative normal state and unitarity?
Well, unitarity means that you have only positive definite probabilities. And this means that in quantum mechanics, the probability in some states to observe, the probabilities to observe, for instance, you have a state phi and you make a measurement. You want to know, does it belongs to the, does it overlaps with some psi? You see? So that's the probability. This is the probability, it's given by this squared. So this is given by phi psi psi. That's one of the standard axioms or properties of reality. So this is a projector on psi. And this has to be always positive. But this is possible only when you sum over all intermediate states that you must get one, etc. So this is possible only if the scalar product which is defined here, these are complex numbers, those are amplitudes. The amplitudes should sum up so that when you sum over phi, for instance, you get one, or if you sum over psi, you get one. And this means you can check that if you assume that you have some kind of scalar products, but you don't know what are its probabilities, the fact that you must have positive probability and that they should sum up to one means that the scalar products phi phi has to be always positive. Otherwise, you run into negative probabilities and probability larger than one. So that's the reason between unitarity. Okay. So unitarity means, of course, it's related to the fact that you can make change of variable in the change of base in the Hilbert space. And unitary means that any change of base of wave, the basis of the wave. Of wave vectors has to be a unitary transformation, and that's possible only if this is zero, is positive. Mm-hmm. So this is a connection between unitarity. Okay.
And if you have written out the sum,
yes,
in terms of the Feynman diagrams, would we have gotten terms such as we saw yesterday, where you commented two of them violate?
I think so. I'm not. I wouldn't want to think about. One has to look at some explicit calculation. But if you when you compute the S matrix element, basically you are computing the transition amplitude, so object like that between incoming states and outgoing states with one Marshall particle. So if for some of these objects, when you take the sum, you get something negative, then you are in trouble. And that's what the calculation gives in gauge theory if you don't take into account the ghosts. Okay? Mm-hmm. Okay, we can discuss that more, but I'd like to go to the other aspects, because that's something which is very important. It's going to be a very short introduction. So that, oops. Now I am going to discuss another very important properties of gauge theories and feature of non-abelian gauge theories, which is the fact that there are topological effects and topological objects, if you want, which is something which is not present in quantum electrodynamism, or the standard one. Standard Maxwell theory, you have no topology. Well, if you had Dirac fermions, Dirac monopoles, you have some topology. But Dirac monopoles appears if you do something, you twist a bit electromagnetism. So I'm not going. So, and the simplest topological object is called the instanton. I'm going to explain what an instanton is. So it's an object which has been discovered by, I think, Belavin, Polyakov, some S, Fartz, and Tweetlin. So this is the famous Belavin from conformal field theory. This is the famous Polyakov for everything in theoretical physics. Schwarz is a famous guy who has worked on supergravity, and Tweetlin is a T from BRST. So, okay. So something that we discovered in the beginning of the 70s. Okay. So I'm going to consider the gate group SU2 because that's just the simplest example. And the fact that there are topological objects in SU2 is based on the fact that the homotopy group of SU2, some homotopy group of SU2 are non-zero, if you know what an homotopy group, but I'm going to explain for the one. Okay, so you can see that in a very simple way by seeing that the group SU2, if you consider it as just a geometrical object, it's the same thing as the three-dimensional sphere, the unit sphere in one dimension, in four dimensions. Unit sphere here in four dimensions, for real dimensions. So this is a complex manifold. This is an object based on the complex group. This is a real object. And the simplest way, well, one simple way to view that is to say that, okay, consider a vector x in R4. It's a vector which is going to have four components, and I'm going to distinguish one time component from the space component. Okay, it's just you choose a direction in R4, you call this x0, and 0 is the one are the vector. Okay, then to such a Higgs, you can associate an element, a group, a matrix G of x, by simply writing x0 times the identity matrix in two by two dimension. So plus the x times a vector made out of the Pauli matrices. So this is a 2x2 complex matrix, you see. This means x1 sigma 1 plus x2 sigma 2 plus x3 sigma 3. That's a compact way to write. So this is x1 sigma 1 plus x2 sigma 2 plus x3 sigma 3. So those are 2x2 matrices. Okay. And this is a 2x2 identity matrix. Okay. And you can check that this is a matrix, and a simple calculation shows that G dagger times G of X is just going to be given by X0 squared plus X squared times 1. You see? So G of X belongs to SU2 if x is 1, the vector, the four-dimensional vector is 1, if x belongs to the unit sphere in three dimensions. So this defines, you see, this defines you know, a bijection between S3 and SU2. So you see that as a geometrical manifold, three-dimensional manifold, real manifold, SU2 is nothing but S3. Okay. Okay, but now that's something interesting, because It means that you can naturally map S3 into SU2. And you know that when you consider a geometrical mapping from S3 to S3, you map the sphere onto the sphere. Well, some mapping are trivial. You map all the points of S3 into a single point in S3. You can have this mapping, but this natural mapping wraps once. And you cannot, if you have this mapping, if you wrap any point on S3 into S3, you cannot deform this mapping to the mapping into a single point. Exactly in the same way that if you map a circle into a circle, you cannot deform this mapping into mapping the circle into a point on the circle. It's just the higher dimensional analog of the fact that the one-dimensional sphere is not contractible. So the fact that this mapping, you know, have some winding number. In mathematics, this is called the fact that the third homotic P group of S3 is non-trivial. So that's called the third homotopy group. And this group is just the integers. It means that you have a winding number, which is an integer. It's a number of rounds that you wrap the sphere onto the sphere, and it can be 0, 1, 2, 3, minus 1, minus 2. Okay. Good. So now I would like to now one can define that's the discovery of this gentleman. That in fact, one can find a gauge field configuration, A mu of x, which is topologically non-trivial. And the simplest way to construct such an example, there are many, it's that, you see, I take a point in R4. Out of a point in R4, I define the unit vector u, which is x divided by the absolute value of x. Okay, so that's a unit vector. So this belongs to S3. That's well defined as long as x is different from 0. Because in 0, this unit vector of 0 is not well defined. But so in R4, out of the origin, this field is just well defined. Okay. So since this is an element of S3, well, you can define a seemingly pure gauge, A mu, which is simply defined by I use this mapping, g minus 1 of u of x, d mu, the ordinary derivative of g of u of x. Okay? Well, you can check. So that's just the definition of a connection which is a pure gauge. You consider a gauge transformation associated to each point of x. You take g minus u d mu, and you get that's called the pure gauge field. That's because, remember, a gauge transformation, when you make a gauge transformation on a general gauge field, you change a mu into a mu, into g. G, E mu, G, I'm sorry, G, A mu plus D mu, G minus 1, with a factor I. Okay? That's the definition of a gauge transformation on a gauge field. If you start from zero, you transform zero into a gauge field which is non-zero, but which is gauge equivalent to zero. Okay. So you do that. For this particular case of, I map a point into its unit vector, I take the G defined by this one, okay? And so you defined for each point of the field a G of X. And if you compute it, in fact, if I made no mistakes, you find that A0 is minus X times sigma over X squared. And the spatial component of A of this gauge field congruation, this is, it have made no mistakes, x0 sigma plus the vector products of x with the vector sigma divided by x squared. Okay, so you see, this is a gauge configuration, which is a pure gauge. So it seems that we have been doing nothing. We have a empty gauge field everywhere, but it has a singularity at the origin. At the origin, you see. So now, out of this A, well, the trick is to smoothen out the singularity at the origin. Here you see you have x divided by x squared, by changing this squared. So change this into A0 into, if I made no mistakes, I'm going to change this by changing x squared into x squared plus r squared. And smoothen out the x squared. And the same for A mu. A is x0 sigma plus x vector sigma divided by x squared plus r squared. Okay, so you see. So well, you see, this is a vector. I take the vector with the product of a vector with a vector made out of the Pauli matrices. So this object is a 2x2 matrix divided by a number. And similarly here, this object is a, well, each component is a Pauli matrix. It's some linear combination of Pauli matrices which depend on the vector x divided by x squared plus x squared. Okay, so this configuration that we built out from this trick is a solution of this BPST instanton. Okay, and what are the properties of this? Yes?
Could you repeat what is the difference between the denominators? Means here in one place
the denomination here I adjust x squared, so it has a singularity at zero. Mm-hmm. There is a pole at zero, and here I have smoothened out x squared by adding some r.
So r is arbitrary.
R is just a number. Sorry, r is just some positive number. You see?
Okay.
And you see that with this, this is smooth at the origin. It's a smooth function. So r is in fact called the radius of the instanton.
Okay. Yes. A solution of the given the classical equations of motion, or it's like
okay. So that's a
so far that's this random function that you have.
No, okay, so this is, okay, it turns out that I've constructed this property to show that it has some winding number because I've constructed it out of the mapping from S3 to SU2. I constructed it to this specific mapping from the sphere to SU2. But for the moment, it can be, it's some configuration. But this, yes.
But after adding R, it's no longer a pure.
No, of course, it's not a pure gauge. Gauge, of course, because we have changed. If R equals zero, this would be a pure gauge everywhere except at the origin where there is a single item. If R is on zero, it's not a pure gauge. And the fact that it's not a pure gauge means, of course, that its field tensor is non-zero. You know, the field tensor F mu nu, it's a gauge invariant quantity, or gauge covariant quantity. So of course, for this instanton, F mu nu of x is different from zero. So it's not a pure gauge. Okay. But you can check that it satisfies the equation of motion. So d of f mu nu and d of f mu nu tilde are zero. It is a classical solution. The equation of motion.
And this instanton has winding number zero?
Has
winding number zero?
No. It has, it's a classical solution with winding number equal to one.
Yeah,
and you can check that since it is constructed, you see, the point is that we have changed 1 over x squared into 1 over x squared plus r squared, you see. So it means that at infinity, goes to infinity, they look the same. You can neglect r squared. So at x equal infinity, this a mu is still a pure gauge, pure is a pure gauge here, this one. But it's different inside the region. And you see, in fact, basically the r squared tells you what is the size. So you have your space, you have your origin, and you have a region of radius r when the field strength is non-zero. And far away, it's a pure gauge. So far away, f mu nu goes to zero. And one can check, you do the calculation, you find that far away, f mu nu decays like 1 over x4, not x squared. You would expect that it would be a 1 over x squared because you have x over x squared. So when you take one derivative, it's 1 over x squared, but it's 1 over x4. So it decays very fast at infinity. Okay. And just a result of the calculation. And in particular, its action, integral d4x trace of f mu nu squared, is finite. So it's a classical solution of the equation of motion, which has a finite action. So it should be counted in the functional integral, but with a winding number one. So which means that in fact, you cannot make a global gauge transformation in space, regular at infinity, which maps it into zero. It cannot be deformed. Zero. In order to deform it from a mu to zero, you have to introduce some singularity somewhere. You see, one example, if you want to reduce it to a pure gauge, you let R goes to zero. So then the radius of the instanton disappears. So everywhere you have a pure gauge, so it's equivalent to zero, but you have a singularity at the infinity. And so in some sense, the winding number is concentrated around the origin. See? Okay, so in fact, there is of course a way to measure what is this winding number. And this winding number, in fact, is called the topological charge. And the topological charge is defined in the following way. I think you have probably met that. Out of the stress energy tensor of the field, of any gauge field, you can define its dual. And you can, it's called F tilde of mu nu or F star of mu nu, which is just, we are in four dimensions. Everything works out in four dimensions because it's only in four dimensions that the boundary of space at infinity is a three. By one half of epsilon mu nu rho sigma F rho sigma. So this is a totally antisymmetric four index symbol. That's an antisymmetric Levy beta symbol. And of course, everything is defined because we are in four dimensions. So the dual of F mu nu is still a four tensor, two tensor. You can define the dual of a four tensor in five dimensions, but then it's going to be a tensor of rank three. Okay. And going from F mu nu to F mu nu tilde, you can do that in electromagnetism, you can do that in a gauge field. Basically, you see the component of F mu nu are E and B, the electric and magnetic field. So going from F to F tilde is just going from interchanging the electric and magnetic field. So this is just electric magnetic duality. F tilde describes field configuration where you have exchanged electric and magnetic field. Okay. This concept of topological charge, in fact, is defined for any gauge field configuration by Q equal, and if I made no mistakes in the normalization, you integrate over this on your spacetime. Instead of taking the gauge field action, you take the trace of F mu nu tilde. Okay? And it turns out that this is always an integer. There is some topological kind of index theorem which states that this is an integer. So this is a way to define by a four-dimensional integral what is what is the winding number of the topological charge of AME. And the fact that it is topological means you see that the fact that it's an integer is that you take a given A. It gives F mu nu, you compute its topological charge. If you make a small variation of A, you change A into something else. A doesn't have to be a classical solution of the equation of motion. You take an A, you change it. A priori, this would change. But since it's an integer, you cannot jump from an integer to another integer by making a small infinitesimal transformation. So this has to be constant under any kind of deformation inside spacetime. And the reason why this is a topological index is that because, in fact, you can write this object as this f mu nu f mu tilde mu nu. You can rewrite this as a d mu of something. F mu nu tilde. You see, you can write this as epsilon mu nu rho sigma f mu nu f rho sigma. And in fact, you can write this as d mu of some k mu. You see, it's a total derivative. Yes?
I'm just trying to understand the motivation for starting from the true gauge, because I can very much understand in condensed matter.
Yes.
If I know what this a mu is supposed to represent,
yes.
But I'm interested in this spin configuration.
Yes.
So I'm just wondering, in addition to having this idea of a topological number, adding this pure gauge, is the motivation that I just can't see this field physically,
yes, yes,
away from one point?
Yes.
And have we observed something like this? Or is that
A is not physical. It's f mu nu, which is physical.
Yeah.
So the instanton is a solution of field equation of motion such that f mu nu is non-zero. It's still an extrema of the equation of motion. So it's a classical solution. But you cannot deform it without making some drastic extension where into a configuration which is close to a configuration, zero configuration, a smooth configuration everywhere. It really has some topological feature in it. And in fact, such instanton, you mentioned spin models in statistical mechanics. You have some spin models in statistical mechanics where you have exactly the same kind of instanton, but they occur in two dimensions. But they have the similar properties. There is a winding number, which is given by some topological charge and given by some sort of kind of formula.
I'm just surprised because we also saw this term in the standard model.
Yeah. I think you have been introduced.
I'm just trying to have a physical picture in mind of what this could be.
I think a physical picture, remember you have this electric and magnetic duality.
Mm-hmm.
So, the energy density in electromagnetism is E squared plus B squared. You see, if you had these terms, it means that you had to that E vectorial B term somehow. Because then you, of course, if you change F in F tilde and take the square, that's okay. But if you take F times F tilde, but E dot B. So you had something like that in your action. But in electromagnetism, E dot B in general is just precisely a derivative of something. So in general, when you integrate a derivative over the whole space, you get a boundary term. So you see, Q can be given by a boundary term. You compute here in your space. Yeah, you have your space time. So you assume that your field strength decays at infinity. I show that it decays. So you have your space time, so here you assume that f is very close to zero. So I integrate f times f bure here like this. Since it's a pure configuration, it's a total derivative, you can rewrite the integral of this inside as some integral of k mu dn mu, where you integrate the flux of k at the boundary. Flux of k. And at infinity. But it turns out for the instanton, the flux of this quantity at infinity in zone zero and is quantized. That's what the math says.
Mm-hmm.
So the flux is quantized. Okay. So this is basically, you see a difference with electromagnetism is that since SU2 is homotopic to the sphere, it has a non-trivial third homotopy group. Therefore, it means that the topology of a gauge field configuration at infinity, since the boundary at infinity is S3, can carry in general a topological number. So the space of all, you know, if you consider the space of all A's, AMU, in perturbation theory, we always consider small deformation of AMU close to AMU equals zero. But the space of all AMU is subdivided into a disconnected sum, a union, rather than a sum, a union for Q integer of the space of AMU with topological charge Q. So the space of field configuration of gauge theories is bigger than what was considered in the perturbation theory, where we considered that only perturbation theory. But you see, this term has an action, and well, the action is something like 16p pi squared, maybe times something. So in fact, if you had those things which are called topological sector of the theory, and you compute the partition function of your gauge theory, your functional integral of dIA of exponential minus s of a, I'm in Euclidean, but you can work out that. Well, you have a sum of a q terms, and you have exponential. Well, it turns out that if you have an instanton, you work out, if you can take two instantons and bring them together, but then you get something which has. So you get the sum of exponential minus, I don't know if it's Q or something like S of instanton. So you have, I don't remember it's Q of Q squared, I have to do the calculation, but anyway. So you have, and S the instanton is some number, but it's divided by G squared. Okay. So you see that instantons introduce effects which are physical effects, which are exponentially small in the Kopli constant. So that's called non-perturbative effect. So in the physics of non-Abelian gauge theories, you have non-perturbative effects induced by the instantons, those classical solutions that you don't see in perturbation theory, but which are present in the functional integral. And for G, not too small. You have to take them into account. And one knows that in gauge theories, the effective coupling constant at large distance is basically of order one. So those topological configuration in the path integral play a role in the physics of gauge theories at strong coupling.
I have a question.
Yes.
When we say that the Q you defined the integral is always an integer, that is there some condition on a mu? Means it should be a pure gauge or it should satisfy the classical equation?
No. This is a definition for any gauge configuration. The only condition is that the gauge field should decay fast enough at infinity so that f mu, this integral, converge at infinity. So the only condition is that f mu nu decays fast enough. Is regular at infinity. And that's the case for our condition.
Yeah,
because for our condition, we have seen that f mu nu behaves like 1 over x4. You may, for instance, enforce that f mu nu decays like 1 over x4.
So that that's integral means for any field configuration, that integral is always an integer by construct.
Yes. Okay. Yes. And that's a theorem of math, right? Okay. It's one of the application of what's called the Atiyah-Singer index theorem. You can, if you know a bit more of theory, you can work this out in terms of differential geometry. Well, I can write the formula if you like, but I won't explain what it is. But you can work out everything in terms of differential forms, and in terms of a connection, which is defined on a G bundle or a space sign where G is a group SU2. And very general and strong theorem in differential geometry apply.
Thank you.
The Atiyah-Singer theorem is something different. It relates some index to something, but that's to do with it. You have a topological object and it's related to some integral of some local object. But it's related also, there is a very simple theorem which is called the Poincaré, the Euler Poincaré theorem, which relates if you have a two-dimensional surface, it relates its Euler characteristic, basically the number of handles of holes in the surface. It's zero for a sphere, it's one for a torus, it's two for a double torus, it's three for a bezel, etc. This, which is a number, can be written as the integral over the scalar curvature of the on the surface. So this is some kind of some curvature term. This is the integral of some curvature of the curvature of the some kind of curvature of the bundle given by A.
Okay.
That's a bit different. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
Thank
you. Yes.
I guess I'm just surprised that this works. I mean, because we need S3, I thought, because we want to talk about space-time.
We need
for four dimensions.
Yes.
But at the same time, we're restricting ourselves to those X with norm one.
No, no. Maybe I should have, I could have started by that, by saying that define from F, for any gauge field, you define F tilde by this, a dual. Compute this. There is a theorem which states that this is a topological number, and then you may ask for q equal one, the simplest solution. There should be somewhere in the space of all q's with topological one. There is one which minimizes its action. So it's going to be minimizing the action means that you have a classical solution. But it is this one. But I prefer to choose a way to just construct a solution out of the fact that there is this mapping with non-trivial winding number one to explain that this solution has a winding number one just from the geometrical way it was constructed, and then go to the general theory. If you prefer, you can. That's the way it is often presented.
Because, these topological terms, they also exist for the other gauge, right?
That's completely independent. Well, here, this is a particular representation, so it's in some gauge. I think it's in the. You can check that this AMU satisfies the Landau gauge. The AMU written like that satisfies the Landau gauge, but I'm not 100% sure. But then you take this AMU, you apply any gauge transformation, you get a different gauge field, but with the same FMU nu up to the gauge transformation.
I guess I was more referring to that you could use a different group than SU2.
Ah, okay. So for now, take SU3. The theory is more complicated, but any SUN group contains an SU2. It contains many SU2. Okay. And this SU2 in SU3, well, you can view that as S3, so you can embed S3 in any SUN. And the fact that P3 of S3 is Z, in fact, is the extension there, big theorem in maths, which states that the pi 3 of SUN is always Z. Because basically, the idea is basically that every SUN contains some S2. And so if you have a sphere in SUN, you can deform it in SUN in order to map it to some group of some sub SU2 of SUN, and then you are done. Of course, this is more, you have to know what is the topology. So this is also a solution for SUN. You just reduce all the other components. You see, for SU3, you have 8 components. You take just the 3 first of them, you map the instanton, you set the other AMU equal to 0, and you get an instanton of SU3. But of course, you may have, in general, you are going to have more Johnson. But you can also say this formula trace of F mu nu, F tilde mu nu, here, the write it in terms of instanton. This is of a color index. You have F mu nu A, F mu nu A, TA. This is trace of TA, TB, where TA and TB are generator of the Lie algebra of SUN. But in any case, trace of TA, TB is 1/2 of delta AB. So the fact that in this formula, the group is not important as long as it's an SUN. For another group, it's going to be a bit different because it's going to depend on the normalization of the generator algebra. But basically, any non-abelian Lie group will have instanton.
Could I just
see
the little
board again? Yes. Well, this is in the notes that I'm supposed to be able to put in the.
Why does all of this survive quantization?
Why?
Why does all of this survive quantization?
Well,
like it does. I mean, because this is pure classical, and this works because that F mu has the interpretation of a crossover group.
No. This is not classical, because this is valid for any field configuration, not only configuration which satisfies the equation of motion.
No, but I mean that the fact that is a topological term, that is because your F is a
problem. I see that. When you quantize the theory, this is present in functional integral. You have those topological sectors in the functional integral. Therefore, those topological effects should be present in the quantum theory. You can formulate those topological effects in canonical quantization, but that's going to be more complicated. So I'm not an expert of that. But those topological effects are present in the quantum theory. Because they are, you can view that because they are present in the functional integral, which defines the quantum theory. So it's not a particularity of classical Young-Mills. It's a property of Young-Mills, quantum or classical.
And is there something equivalent that doesn't happen in the classical sector? Happens in the quantum sector?
Well, in the classical sector, you choose one of the sectors you are because you cannot move from one to another one.
Are there topological effects that are quantum by nature and not equivalent in the classical theory?
This is topological defect which has a classical limit.
Yeah, that's my point. There's a topological defect that doesn't have any equivalent if I were to do
one
in classical theory?
Good question. I'm not sure. Probably because the audition have been very clever at inventing things. But I think the instanton has, in some sense, already present at the semi-classical level.
Yeah, that would
be
something classical that is produced in classical theory.
Well, okay, I prefer not to answer more because I don't know really an answer to your question, but that's an interesting question. You had a question?
Yeah, I was just wondering
can you have superpositions of configurations with different topological charges in general?
You mean superposition in the functional integral? Or
right. I guess I'm wondering, so we do the, let's say we do the path integral, right?
Yes.
And we convert to Hilbert space after we've done that.
Yeah.
We get some field configuration in Hilbert space based on this path integral quantization. I'm just wondering, do there exist non-trivial superpositions of different topological charges in the operator?
I think you might have.
Some sort of like selection or super selection rules.
You are right. In fact, since you have topological effect, you have a symmetry. In fact, when you look at the quantum theory in terms of operators, you have super selection rules. You have a theory which can have different vacua, but in the infinite volume limit, they belong to different super selection rules. Super selection sectors. So some of the quantum superposition of states are not, in fact, observable, because if these states belongs to different super selection sectors, you can define mathematically quantum superposition of them, but you are never going to observe them. So there are super selection sectors associated to those quantum numbers, to those topological effects.
And can you ever get, I'm just wondering, are there ever transitions between these sectors? Is that the whole point of the super selection, is that there's...
Sectors and super selections, topological sectors and super selection sectors are something a bit different. The way instanton plays a role in quantum theory is often stated by the fact that you have different topological vacua, and the instanton mediate a quantum transition between those vacua. But that's exactly in the same way that, for instance, you know, if you consider a quantum particles in a sign potential, just an ordinary quantum, so we are in one time dimensions. Okay, you have several classical vacua. They are all equivalent. If you are just there, you don't know whether you are in this one or in this one. It's this one. If you are doing semi-classical analysis, you just explore what is inside vacua, but you know that by classical effects, that just tunneling effect, you can tunnel from this to this. And taking this into account, you get basically the band structure of, you use this as an electron in a solid, and it just hops from place to place. You get very important quantum effects associated with the fact that you can jump from this to this. And basically, instead of having just a discrete spectrum, if you are only in one vacua, well, you get bands. The bands of solid state physics. So the same thing occurs in gate theories. But I won't have time to discuss that. And there has been a lot of speculation. Instantons are very interesting, but people have tried to use them to explain a lot of things. And for some things, like for instance, try to use to say that they were on the basis of a confinement mechanism in non-Abelian gate series. But this has not been really fully successful. So there are some models of instanton gas which have some phenomenological success. But that's not the end of the story. Okay, well, sorry, I'm taking too much time. Well, you can ask more questions in private or because that's just a glimpse of a very vast subject.
What are we going to talk about next week?
Next week, I plan to talk about renormalization theory. Well, some aspects, because I have only three lectures. I had also planned to, was also planning to discuss the X mechanism, but I'm not sure. Well, it would mean one lecture and two lectures for renormalization, and that's probably not enough. So, but I know that you have studied already renormalization theory in QFT 1 and 2. And Wilson, and the X mechanism in the standard model. So anyway.